Welcome back to Current State. This is 90.5 WKAR, and I'm Mark Bayshore. Cases of autism have surged in this country in recent years, as you may know. Later this hour, medical historian Dr. Jeffrey Baker, who is also a pediatrician, gives us some valuable historical context for a better understanding of this disorder and the history of this disorder, which is in the news more and more. I can't help but notice today that in suburban Detroit, teens on the autism spectrum are being given a unique chance to prepare for medical emergencies associated with autism. I recommend an article in this morning's Detroit News headline, Autistic Teens Get Hands-On Experience. Beaumont Hospital is offering this service. These are simulated medical emergencies, but the kids get to use actual medical equipment to offer aid. Check it out. Detroit News, and we'll talk with Dr. Jeffrey Baker and others coming up on this edition of Current State. There will be another delay in the release of the report reviewing the response of the Lansing Board of Water and Light to last December's huge ice storm. Several sources, including our next guest, have told WKAR the highly anticipated findings of the independent community review team are likely to be announced in early May. The panel's report was first targeted for March 31st, but then postponed until about mid-April. To update this matter and others involving the utility, Current State welcomes back the vice chair of the BWL Board of Commissioners, Dennis Lowney. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me today.
Thank you for coming in. We do appreciate it. Sandy Zirkle, your board's president, told me late Friday that she heard from General Manager Peter Lark that the CRT report could take until early May, but her belief was probably it would take no more than a week into the month. What's your understanding?
I think by the second week in May, they'll be done with it. It's been pretty comprehensive. I know I've talked both with General McDaniel and some other members, actually had been asked to testify to them on some of my insights that I saw.
Okay.
And in compiling the information, I think they really wanted to be very specific. And what that entailed was really going through and interviewing employees, interviewing some of the municipalities, and not just looking at what were the problems, but what are the solutions? Is it part of the organizational structure? Is it part of internal operations? Is it part of the software? So I think they're really trying to take a large overview of really, what is the problem here, and why did this happen, and how can it be prevented in the future?
They want to dig deeper then.
Yes.
Okay. And that's what the delay is accountable to. It's
correct.
Just that desire to dig deeper and to really offer a more substantive final report.
Well, and I think the other part is if you look at the composition of those members on that CRT team, you've got a wide diversity of people, from neighborhood activists to city managers to Cooley Law professors. And so to bring those people together and coordinate their schedules, that has certainly been a difficult task in some ways.
Are you, we will remind our listeners that the members of the CRT serve voluntarily as well. Virtually all of them have other full-time jobs. Are you and the other members of the board communicating much with General McDaniel and other members of the CRT?
Not that I'm aware of. I've gotten occasional emails from him. I attended all the hearings that they had and talked to him a couple times, and I know some of the members on the CRT, and so I reached out to them just to give them my insights.
I'm being informed, by the way, ironically, that we are 4 months to the day since the ice storm struck here in Lansing. Last week, the Lansing State Journal reported, and you acknowledged, that the board was not informed of 10 safety violations and of more than $10,000 in state penalties paid stemming from a 2011 incident at the Wise Road water plant. A lot of our listeners will remember that. I remember that. Indeed, the paper reported that you and board members David Price and Cynthia Ward said you learned about the fines from the Lansing State Journal when it called. From your perspective, what went wrong here?
In regards to the fines or in regards to the overall?
In regards to your learning about the fines from the newspaper when they called.
Right. When this incident occurred in 2011, we were first informed of the basics of what had happened and how the accident had occurred. At that time, they were doing an investigation, and we were told we would get an update. It had been a while since we had an update, and several members had asked for that update earlier this year. But based on the ice storm and the issues we encountered, we put that off. So the last committee of the whole meeting, I asked for an update, and it was given by the general manager and by Dick Peffley, who handles a lot of our operations. And they gave a presentation in regards to what the fixes were and really what how financially it impacted us. But at no time did they mention that there were MyOSHA violations. So later on, Steve Reed had asked for more information on it and found out that there, and Steve Reed is the Lansing State Journal reporter.
Right.
They had asked for more information, and he discovered that there were MyOSHA violations. And he called me and a couple of other members, as you indicated on the board, Cynthia Ward and David Price, and asked what our thoughts were on those. And I indicated that I had not been informed. We get regular monthly updates from the general manager in regards to any legal action that's occurring, and I would have thought that this would have been included with that information. But to give an update to our board in regards to an accident that occurred and not comment on MyOSHA violations, to me, was very disturbing to the board. And I know that at least one board member did talk to the general manager afterwards to make sure it was very clear that that didn't occur again.
Hmm. Yeah. According to the State Journal article, you and others requested information for 32 months. And until Dick Peffley responded at this last meeting that you just referred to, you didn't get anything. And indeed, when Mr. Peffley offered his description, it offered what the paper described as a silver lining scenario. Quote, no injuries, substantial insurance reimbursement, and a virtually new plant nearing its full nearing its return to full automation, no mention of fines, and a round of applause from those attending. What is wrong with this scenario? How do you correct this? Who does this fall to for the board to be aware of something so important?
Well, it's a shared diligence, I think. It falls basically on management. It's their responsibility to inform the board, but it's also the board's responsibility to request information. I think it's been made very clear to the general manager that these are important issues. If it's a state violation, if we're violating state law, that we need to be informed as a board.
Sure.
And in talking to the general manager, he indicated that he thought that that was operations, that at times they may get notices on a MyOSHA violation, they're mitigated, they may be dismissed. In fact, I know some of the violations were actually dismissed and the fines were reduced, that the initial request from the state showing the violations, several of those were pared down after information was supplied. But getting back to answer your question, really it's management's responsibility to keep us informed.
Should that disclosure have been in one of these monthly reports from the general manager that you alluded to earlier? Is that your opinion?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you think the board, I mean, it would, the article did not make the board look good. Does the board need to take a more aggressive approach to getting information like this?
I would say yes, and I think we're starting to do that. We're starting to use our committee of the whole as more of an investigatory type of committee where we can start asking more questions. We've discussed creating another committee, an IT committee, to review when technology is introduced. For instance, a lot of the problems with the ice storm occurred due to an outage management system that was not working correctly. We should have been better informed on that, but it's also our responsibility to look into these things, to be responsible for that. So I think it was a learning lesson, and we made mistakes, and I don't want to say that the board should be absolved of anything, but we are volunteers. We do have jobs. And part of our responsibility and oversight is really asking more questions, and we need to do a better job of that. And
How hard do you expect that to be, Dennis? I mean, getting that information, does this represent a real difference in approach as to how the board gets information and how aggressive it's accustomed to being?
I think it's a change of culture in some ways, because things have operated smoothly at the Board of Water and Light. Things have worked effectively. But what we're starting to see is a pattern here where there was information that wasn't shared with the board that perhaps we could have asked for changes, or we could have done a better job investigating it to find out why was this being delayed, or should we hold off on that. We ultimately are responsible for oversight, but we aren't responsible for the day-to-day operations. So there's a fine line between coming in and trying to micromanage as opposed to providing good oversight. And I think what we're finding now is we need to dig deeper. We need to ask the general manager. We need to ask the CFO. We need to look into our technology and start to say that, well, we put a new system in place and everything's working. There were a couple bugs. Well, what bugs were those? What are we doing to address those? Mm-hmm. And in the past, those seemed to be handled. But I think what we're finding is, and I think this was due to the economy and the changes. If you look back to when we went through that economic recession and the GM plants closed, we lost, that was our biggest customer. We had a huge bill that they did not pay, and when they went into bankruptcy. So when you look at that, the mantra that we've heard as a board over the past 4 years really has been, we're doing more with less. Well, I think less caught up with us at this time. And if you go through the storm outage report, that we're getting updates at every committee of the whole meeting. We've got a timeline of when those 54 recommendations will be implemented. I think when you look at that, you start to see, well, they're hiring in customer service area. They're hiring in tree trimming. Those were areas where you try to control the rates. You don't want to continue to ask for rate increases. But you also have to look at what's impacting you with federal guidelines for mercury emissions. That was part of the purpose of building the new plant, because we would have faced some huge fines there, that then those costs would have been passed back to our ratepayers. So it's not an easy situation, but I think what we're doing is we're trying to weigh those benefits of how can we deliver the best service to our customers at an affordable cost.
A lot of public ire has been focused on Peter Lark, as we all know. Are you concerned with how you and other board members might be assessed in the CRT report?
I think I said it in early January or late February. We didn't do our job. And I say that to the sense that we should have provided better oversight on this as a board. And I'm not making an excuse. We are volunteers. But I think we have a responsibility to our customers and to the public when we sit on that board. And we are doing a better job. I know all of the board members, we've made a commitment to making sure this is going to be fixed and it's not going to happen again. And I've said many times I apologize to all our customers. We didn't handle this well. We made mistakes. But as long as I'm on the board, I'm going to make sure that doesn't happen again.
One result of the BWL's internal review was this set of 54 action items, reforms that the utility is moving forward on. What can you tell us about those?
Well, I think as we heard in the public hearings, there were a lot of issues that came up. And this was an internal investigation, and there was a lot of skepticism, obviously, that, oh, you're going to investigate yourself, and then you're going to fix everything and move on, and it's really not going to fix things. So you're just giving us lip service. This was a pretty comprehensive report. I had a lot of questions when it was released. So did other board members. We spent 3.5 hours going through it. I had more than 10 pages of questions. I felt very comfortable coming out of that committee of the whole meeting that the board was able to answer that the management was able to answer that. Now, the recommendations are great if you have recommendations and you implement them. So what we've made a commitment as a board to is we wanted timelines, we wanted completion dates, we wanted updates at every month at our committee of the whole to say, where are we at? And at the end of the year, we're going to have a hearing, probably a committee of the whole hearing, and give a report that we'll issue to show what has been done. What was this like a year ago? And what were our problems? And what have we done to correct those? So that we can assure our customers that we're taking care of the problems. We listen to their concerns.
Do you think that the 54 action items, is the aim there to preempt a lot of the findings that the community review team will probably include in its final report? In a way to demonstrate, hey, we're already on a lot of these things? Is that
I think so.
Part of the aim here?
I think so. I mean, we had a storm that hit us that was unlike any other storm, and we found problems within our organization. So moving forward, we asked for an internal investigation to figure out how did this happen and how are we going to prevent it in the future? There's always a concern that it's the fox guarding the hen house and we're not fixing our problems. So I think the mayor wanted to make sure that there was due diligence in investigating, and he appointed the CRT team. So are we preempting them? I think being a good organization, we're just doing what we should be doing. I think the CRT team is going to have more recommendations, and we'll be working with them to help implement them.
Dennis Lowney is vice chair of the Board of Commissioners for the Lansing Board of Water and Light. We've been talking, we've been updating all matters BWL here. Dennis, we appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank
you. Have a great day.
Tomorrow is the filing deadline for all potential political candidates to run in the August 5th primary. Last month, 8th District Republican Congressman Mike Rogers shocked many of his constituents with news that he will not seek re-election. So far, former Michigan Senate Majority Leader Mike Bishop, also a Republican, has formally thrown his hat into the ring. So have Democrats Ken Darga, the former state demographer, and Central Michigan University professor Susan Grettenberger. Now one more Democrat is announcing his bid for Congress. Current State's Kevin Lavery is here to tell us more. Hi, Kevin.
Hello, Mark.
So the third Dem to announce is from county government, but it's not Barb Byram.
That's right. It is not Barb Byram. That Democrat is Ingham County Treasurer Eric Schertzing. He is a very familiar name in mid-Michigan. Many people also know Eric as the chair of the Ingham County Land Bank. He's been circulating petitions to get his name on the August primary ballot. He's shooting for 2,000 signatures. And I spoke with him recently about his possible run and some of the attributes that he believes he can bring to Washington.
I think I can bring my problem-solving skills that I've learned as an administrator in county government to Washington. And Washington sorely needs people that can solve problems rather than just fight about them.
What led you to the decision that that was the right seat for you, and when did you decide that it was the right time to enter?
I looked at this seat a year ago when the incumbent was looking at a U.S. Senate run. He chose not to do that, so we put that on the back burner. It was March 28th when the incumbent decided not to run. You have to seize the opportunities that present themselves in life. My kids are old enough for me to do this. My wife's on board. The kids are on board. It's an open seat. I just think it's the timing is right.
The filing deadline is Tuesday. Have you officially filed as a candidate?
No, we'll probably do that on Tuesday. We're getting all of our petitions together and verified and all that good stuff, but that's all coming together well.
What kind of conversations are you having with the Democratic leadership in this state about strategy and priorities if you're elected to the seat?
Well, you know, we're early. We're having all those conversations. I'm trying to get a campaign team thought about and assembled, and then the fundraising and stuff takes over. So there's just a lot of conversations going on. Got to get those petitions, you know, got a bank account open up, all these fun things, but we're just doing the work.
Well, how many signatures do you need for petitions?
It's 1,000 to 2,000, so we're going for the 2,000 figure, as close as we can get to that, and I think we'll be pretty close.
Most pressing issues or needs in the 8th District, in your estimation?
You know, I think infrastructure issues are really what I want to spend some time talking about. So that's both education. We need to work on education, make it more affordable, more available, invest in the people. And then this winter was certainly a clarion call that we need to do better on infrastructure. So our roads, our water, sewer, all of that is something that we've got to prioritize to create jobs for our public and to make America strong at home.
How do you think you'll find the balance if you're elected between focusing, of course, on the district versus being part of the larger body of Congress and dealing with national issues that, of course, will come across your desk?
That's the fascinating growth phase of this experience. I can try to imagine that. But, you know, I think most things in life, you really have to live them to know what it's like. People know that I'm a problem solver, a hard worker. I've got proven job creation experience. I'm going to roll up my sleeves and do whatever needs to be done to help this district and state.
So when can we expect a formal announcement with all the hurrah that comes with that?
Oh, should be this week.
Eric Schertzing is the Ingham County Treasurer and potential candidate for the U.S. 8th Congressional District seat. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you, Kevin.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
We'll also point out that there are two GOP candidates for the 8th Congressional District in Michigan. The other one is Rochester Hills Mayor Brian Barnett, in addition to Mike Bishop. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. April is Autism Awareness Month. Autism is a condition that's much examined by the medical community, but still elusive in its causes and treatments. Here with us now to look at the history of the condition is Dr. Jeffrey Baker. Dr. Baker's a pediatrician and medical historian, and last fall he wrote a historical perspective on autism that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Baker, welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark.
First of all, help us with just the basic terminology here. We people talk about autism. We also hear about autism spectrum disorder. Help us understand these phrases.
Sure. Well, autism, for most of my professional career, has been defined in terms of a triad of really involving three different domains. The first is an impaired ability to relate to other people. The second domain is either absent language or atypical language, you know, characterized, for example, by echolalia, by repeating phrases, by using language, by just repeating language instead of using it to communicate. And the third domain would be what's known as called rigid and repetitive behaviors. Children with autism have unusual attachments to objects. They may like to do the same things over and over and typically don't have a lot of imaginative play. So that's kind of classic autism. In the 70s and 80s, the term used to be just reserved for children who are very severely afflicted. It was a very rare condition. Then it was recognized that autism is really more of a continuum. For example, the label of Asperger's syndrome came in. That was a term used to designate people who have normal language, normal intelligence, or at least normal functional language, but can't use, but still have difficulty conversing, tend to converse in a one-sided kind of way, or maybe have difficulties with the give and take of normal conversation. Another label that will be well known to people in the autism community is sometimes known as PDD for short, stands for Pervasive Developmental Disorder, not otherwise specified. And this is a term that's been used to refer to children with milder degrees of autism. Maybe if you think of classic autism as suggesting a complete inability to relate to other people, there are some kids who might respond to other people but not initiate engagement. There might be other kids who want to engage with others but don't know how. So in the course of the 80s and 90s, you had these other labels circulating more and more, Asperger's, PDD, NOS. And most recently, with DSM-5, the decision was made to group them all together, that drawing the boundaries between these labels was very problematic. So with DSM-5, we have one category just called autism spectrum disorder that embraces all of these.
Hmm. This is a condition that's had a name for at least 70 years or thereabouts. Can you take us back to who was considered the discoverer of this disorder and what they thought it was?
Yeah, so autism, unlike a lot of diseases, really has a birthday. It was described, it really appears quite suddenly on the medical scene with a paper by a Johns Hopkins psychiatrist named Leo Kanner, who in this 1943 paper described 11 children with what he believed was a distinct and never-before-described syndrome. And you can still read these case descriptions today, and they're quite vivid. But they all shared what he called a profound inability to relate to others. And instead, these kids seemed to relate to objects. People kind of scared them, but objects they loved to do the same things over and over, and to routines. Strikingly, he thought that they all had normal intelligence. That the first kids were described with pictures more like the picture we might be familiar with on Rain Man. So it's a very distinct and categorical kind of description that Kanner produced in the 1940s.
It's interesting. We understand that originally autism was thought to be caused by, quote, cold or withdrawn mothers.
Right. Well, it's almost true. So Kanner wrote that the characteristics of the parents in his population were almost as distinct as those of the children themselves.
Hmm.
A huge number of his parents had advanced degrees, many in the sciences, and he said that they were tended to be highly intelligent, often in an abstract kind of way. Now, Dr. Kanner actually focused more on fathers than he did on mothers, but psychoanalysts who were gaining tremendous power in American culture in the 40s and 50s took Kanner's observations, flipped them around, and instead said, no, it's the mother. And psychoanalysts argued that what autism really was the response of an infant to a cold, unfeeling, even though perhaps very intelligent, mother. It was infant's withdrawal in mm-hmm. response to this kind of mother. This became known popularly as the refrigerator mother era.
Oh, my gosh.
Even seems that Dr. Kanner was never quite sure about this. He vacillated between whether this was a effect of dynamics or whether it was a genetic correlation. And as I said, he tended to focus more on the fathers and whether there was some kind of connection of continuity of these kids' genetic makeup. But you can think of the 1940s, 50s, and 60s as being just a dark age of autism, a terrible, terrible period for parents.
We're discussing autism with Dr. Jeffrey Baker. Dr. Baker's a pediatrician and medical historian here, and April is Autism Awareness Month. When did cases of autism start to really noticeably increase?
Well, I think you'd have to say the 1980s, but it all began in the 1980s. Now, we should make clear that the refrigerator mother era went away, so by the time you get to the 70s, autism is being redefined as biologic, and there's more and more interest in genetics. But I think for our sake, as autism was redefined in the 70s and the DSM, the psychiatric manuals, first gave it clear-cut definitions, it was still considered to be very rare and categorical by and large.
Mm-hmm.
One epidemiologic survey in the late 1960s suggested an incidence of about 2 in 10,000, which is quite a contrast with most recent estimates of the CDC. Which, to put it, the most recent is saying 1 in 68, I believe. So what's gone on there? I think everyone agrees, there's widespread agreement that autism is being diagnosed much, much more. There is also widespread consensus that much of this rise is fueled by social and definitional factors. For example, the expansion of the definition, what I've already alluded to, the addition of Asperger's and PDD to describe the milder cases.
Right.
That's clearly part of what's going on. Just the fact that we have much better early intervention systems seeking to detect these kids. We have better services, giving parents an incentive to obtain services. Autism, I think, over time became a diagnosis with much less stigma than mental retardation. you see a shift of kids without the diagnosis into autism as well. All this plus public awareness, all these things came together and certainly have contributed to the rise of the diagnosis of autism.
Continue, please.
I was just going to say, what we don't know is whether or not this explains the entire rise. And the best work, which has been done in California, trying to look at the rise in cases there, has been able to account for at least half of the rise with these kind of factors I've alluded to. but still leaves unexplained quite a bit of the rise. So I think we all need to have a bit of humility about just what is going on here. There still may well be a prenatal influence.
A recent
or some kind of environmental exposure.
A recent article in The Atlantic suggested that earlier treatment of autism is better, but that then the potential for misdiagnosing kids who are just slow developers also goes way up. That sounds like a huge challenge.
It is. Now, I guess the same point can be made of almost any early intervention. You know, early intervention for there are kids who truly have language disorders who will be picked up with early intervention, and then there's some kids who are just late talkers who will speak normally on their own. We clearly do need to do more work on trying to find what predicts a child who's going to do well long term, who's going to recover on their own versus those who need intervention. But I think it's still unemphasized at this point in time. Our best bet for making a big impact on autism is to find these kids early. What you do in that year while you're waiting is profoundly important. And if you don't do anything, some of those kids who are not talking will maybe simply be put in front of a TV screen, and their symptoms will get worse. So I think at this point we do need to emphasize early intervention as our best tool.
One side story here to this larger topic is the issue of parents who believe that certain vaccines caused autism. And that could be another show in itself. But just briefly, if you could tell us what's happened there and how that's affected the discussion.
Well, as autism cases rose in the 1990s, I think you'd find different groups of parents and professionals responded in different ways. Many mainline researchers in academic institutions believe that the rise was just what they expected all along, as the definition was being expanded and they're looking for cases more intensively. But to many parents in the community, it just seemed that there were just far too many cases, that there really was a rise. It was parents who especially coined the term, parents, I should say, allied with what I might call the more dissident practitioners who coined the term autism epidemic. And they, in turn, tended to focus on vaccines. We probably don't have time to go into the specific vaccine controversies, one focused on MMR and one on the presence of a preservative containing mercury. Both of those, I've just acknowledged that I think it's quite possible that something environmental may be going on with the rise in autism. I think it's a false dichotomy to say that autism is either all definition or it's vaccines. There's a third possibility, which is that there's something else environmental going on, maybe more at the prenatal level. And I do think at this point that the one possible environmental exposure that we can say has really been exhaustively researched is actually that of vaccines. And the evidence really has not supported any role.
So this is interesting. So there's a spectrum in terms not only of the disorder itself and how it manifests itself, but in terms of causation as well.
I think increasingly we are moving toward a model that there's probably some kind of genetic predisposition. We know identical twins are much more likely to both be affected with autism than fraternal twins. But there's still something else going on. And I think there's still a lot of interest in looking at the prenatal period and looking at some other factor that could explain that, you know, what causes certain genetically predisposed kids to actually develop autism.
Is there a discovery or a factor that the medical world feels would really substantively move treatment or prevention options forward here?
I think the medical world is looking hard for those kind of interventions. I think there's a lot of interest in trying to better understand different subtypes of autism, and maybe some of those could be matched with more of a specific treatment. But so far, specific treatments, medical treatments, have proven very elusive. Our best bet at this point is more intensive behavioral intervention directed at young children.
This has been a very enlightening discussion. We really appreciate it. Dr. Jeffrey Baker is a pediatrician and medical historian. We've been discussing autism. April is Autism Awareness Month. Dr. Baker, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. A new eco-friendly business will hit the ground pedaling tomorrow. Go Green Trikes will employ electric-assisted bikes to make deliveries in the greater Lansing area. Yvonne Lefebvre is the founder and president of Go Green Trikes. Yvonne, welcome to Current State.
Well, thank you.
Tell us about the origin of this idea. What inspired you to launch this business?
Well, let's see. I have lived without a car for, well, a few years, since about 1990. And,
wow.
Yeah. And I wanted to somehow create a business around not using a vehicle to show people what's possible.
Was living without a vehicle easier than you thought it would be, or did you have to make a lot of changes?
Well, there, you know, some changes, like creating or making a bike that can use that can do cargo delivery sort of stuff. You know, like create or purchase a bike that will let me do bulk food sort of things. You know,
more than just ride your bike back and forth to work. Actually
exactly.
Perform some other service. I see.
Yeah, you know, like 40 pounds of dog food is a lot to carry on a bike.
So your website says that these trikes are capable of carrying 600 pounds. Describe for us what they look like.
Picture, if you will, a flatbed pickup on a tricycle frame. That's pretty much what we're getting.
Wow.
Yeah, so, and when you talk about one with a pickup truck with a topper, that's kind of pretty much the space that will be allowed on the back of these things, something like 93 cubic feet.
How fast can they go?
About 15 miles per hour is top speed.
And 600 pounds of cargo. How many bikes are in your fleet?
Well, to start with, this is the pilot year, so I'll be having one of the big ones and something called an ELF. And I don't know if you looked up that on the website, but it's kind of like, oh, if a recumbent trike and a Smart for Two kind of got together, this is kind of what it would look like.
who's your clientele here, Yvonne? Who are you going to go after to solicit their business?
I have the New Citizen Press. I will be doing bulk delivery for them in downtown Lansing. I also have the Allen Marketplace Exchange. They do bulk produce deliveries to restaurants, institutions, schools, and I'll be doing deliveries for them. And there are probably five more that are in the works, and that's without doing a whole lot of outreach so far.
You're obviously committed to green transportation in your own life. You mentioned that you've lived without a car since 1990. Do you hope your business will inspire others to think twice about their transportation method?
You know, it's possible. I wouldn't be surprised if people did look at that and go, hey, I might be able to do something different too.
How did your awareness how did the importance of alternative transportation take shape for you?
I think it started as a kid, really, because I've had both grandparents were Depression era kids, and they grew up without ever having driven. So I knew it was possible to live without a car, and then when in 1990, when you're talking about the Gulf War and all these chants of no blood for oil, and I'm a rather peaceful person, and I couldn't stand the thought of being part of that. So I kind of looked to my grandparents' example and tried to live without a car.
We're talking with Yvonne Lefebvre, the president and founder of Go Green Trikes, which will employ electric-assisted bicycles to make deliveries in the greater Lansing area. And when did you realize you could realistically launch your business on Earth Day?
Actually, it came to me in about January that it could work. And, yeah, Earth Day would be the perfect day to do it.
The stars were aligning.
Yes, it was.
Have you practiced deliveries with this yet? How have you prepared for your first day?
I have been biking and doing cargo on my own for, gee whiz, at least 5 to 7 years. So I know it's possible, and I know I can do it. And I've been testing out the equipment as I get it. Like right now I have a 9-foot trailer that I've been testing out, and that trailer will do 600 pounds as well. I also have the ELF, which will do up to 350 pounds. So I've been working with those. The big trike comes probably, looks like first week in May. So as soon as that comes, it'll be hitting the road too.
Will you be sharing the street with cars here, or will you be off to the side, or what?
Well, these vehicles can go anywhere that legally that a bicycle can. So I will probably be in the bike lane. The big one, if I have a load especially, I might have to take the lane.
Very interesting. Yvonne Lefebvre is the founder and president of Go Green Trikes, which officially launches tomorrow here on Earth Day in the greater Lansing area. Yvonne, thank you and good luck.
Thank you.
Right now in Boston, runners from around the world are assembling to run the 2014 Boston Marathon, which starts within the hour. This long-standing tradition in the running world is even more significant to its participants this year in light of last year's bombing of the event. A number of people from mid-Michigan are participating, and current state's Melissa Benmark caught up with one of them last week. Well, not literally. She doesn't run that fast. But she spoke with Lansing native Elizabeth Demers, who these days is an acquisitions editor in Chicago. Demers didn't get hooked on running until she was well into adulthood.
I started distance running at 35, roughly. I'd moved to Lincoln, Nebraska from Michigan, and I'd kind of dabbled in running a little bit in Michigan, but I'd never run a race. And when I moved to Nebraska, my new coworkers just signed me up for a race even before they met me. And so I walked the first one, and then I thought, well, I could do better than that. And so did another 5K, and I ran it. And then I was like, oh, I think I could do better than that. So I did a 10K, and I ran that. And then I finally got to the point where I'm like, oh, I'm going to do a half marathon. So I ran that. And then, you know, what's the next step?
That's amazing. I didn't realize they signed you up without actually checking with you first.
They needed an extra person on their company team, and they were like, oh, yeah, sure, she'll do it. You know, they didn't know. And I was so new that I didn't dare say, no, I won't do it.
So what kind of training then is involved to get yourself from there to the place where you could consider being in the Boston Marathon? I mean, what kind of daily or weekly routine do you have?
Well, it depends on every race that I run. So your training for a half marathon is going to be a little different from your training for a full marathon. And I think I ran maybe three halves before I actually finally ran my first race, which was the 2007 Chicago Marathon. And I found a training program from Runner's World, and it was 3 days a week, which fit into my life pretty well. And I had a pretty good race. And I thought, oh, okay, well, so I did another marathon, and I did the same training plan. And then when I did my Boston qualifying race, which was the 2012 Detroit Marathon, I used the Hanson's training plan, and they have a running store in suburban Detroit, and a really pretty radical training plan, and it was great. And so in that plan, you go out and run every day, and you run faster, but you don't necessarily run longer distances. In the first training program I used, you kind of built up to having, you know, you had your one regular run. You have what you call a tempo run, which is when you kind of run faster, and then you have speed work, and then you have a long run every week. So you kind of build up to your 20-miler, and the standard philosophy for running a marathon is that you have to build up to your 20-miler. And the Hanson's plan isn't like that at all. You run three 16-mile runs before you go out and do your marathon.
And you're in Chicago now, so how in the world do you, especially with a winter, like if yours has been anything like ours, how do you train outside during?
Oh, it's been terrible. It's been absolutely terrible. I belong to a gym that has a track, quarter-mile track, so that's been really helpful. And the treadmill, but sometimes you just have to, like, gut it out. You know, you have to have the right gear. You have to have warm socks, and you have to have gloves, and you have to have an ear snuggie, and you have to, you know, have a windbreaker. So if you have gear, you can get out there and do it. But it's more psychological than it is anything else. I mean, it's a lot easier to not run than it is to go run, especially if the weather is fighting you.
You mentioned when we were talking before this that qualifying for this Boston Marathon was on the complicated side, in part because of the bombing last year. What can you explain a little bit about that for our non-running lay people out there?
Sure. To get into the Boston Marathon, you have to run a time that is specific to your age and sex. So I'm 47. I had to run a 3:55 qualifying time. And at Detroit in 2012, I ran a 3:53:21. So that should be enough. But the cutoff really kind of changes every year based on how many people are trying to get into Boston and how fast they've run. So after the bombing, there was a huge groundswell of support for Boston, and people wanted to run it, and they wanted to support the victims, and they wanted to support the city of Boston. And I wasn't sure that I would even get in, even with what I thought was a pretty good cushion on my qualifier. And I ended up getting in by 1 second, so I'm really happy.
Wow. So you were already thinking about and working toward Boston 2014 before the bombing last year. Do you remember where you were and what your reaction was last year when you found out about the bombing?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I was sitting in a class. I was taking an all-day seminar that day, and I didn't have access to the internet or, you know, I wasn't watching television or anything. And so I started getting all these text messages on my phone from people who knew that I had qualified previously, asking me if I was in Boston and I was okay. And I kept thinking, what's going on? What's going on? And I found out that somebody had bombed the Boston Marathon. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I couldn't get my head around it. Who would bomb a marathon? A marathon is the most inclusive, kind of happiest place you can be. And it just really threw me. And at that point, I knew that there would be that huge groundswell of support. And so I just kept my fingers crossed that my time was going to be good enough. And I'm just really honored to be able to run it this year with everybody else and to be part of that crowd that standing up against that kind of oppression. So,
do you think that because there was the bombing last year, that will sort of be in the back of your mind as a nervousness factor? Or do you think that once you get there, there'll be enough for you to think about, you know, just doing the race? I mean, do you have a sense of kind of where that will put you?
I haven't really even thought about the bombing and safety as a nervous creating issue, because the security is just so tight this year. They've changed a lot of rules, and I mean, I think they've got that really well covered. And the Boston Marathon is such a huge thing in and of itself, even without that. So I do have nerves, but they're more about just, you know, having gotten to the pinnacle of racing. And I'm not going to win it. You know, I'm not going to be fast. I'm probably not going to requalify when I'm there, but I'm just so excited to be there and so kind of just nervous about, you know, being in the right place and getting where I need to go. And so there's all these logistics that you have to deal with. And I'm really excited about the race itself, the crowds and the towns that you go through. And it's just supposed to be so wonderful. And I think it's going to be just extra amazing this year because of everything that's been going on.
I seem to remember you were in the one Chicago marathon where it was really hot and people were just dropping and one runner died and people ended up in the hospital. I seem to remember some story with them telling you to stop and you wouldn't stop.
That was my first marathon ever, and I had, you know, I was really super nervous, and it was a huge deal for my life, and I talked to everybody I knew that I'm doing this marathon. It's going to be great, right? And you know, I can't go out. I can't do anything because I'm running this marathon. And I get there, and it's a hot day, and I hadn't run enough to know that I was supposed to be worried about it, because it'd been hot all summer, and I'd been training all summer. And so as you're running along, and it's a very slow race, and I didn't know any better, and people are sweating, and the aid stations are full, and there's sirens everywhere. And I was about mile 20 when we got this announcement that the race had been canceled. And if you were after mile 13, you could finish the race. But they were yelling at people to stop running. I mean, the police were standing in the streets and yelling, stop running. And I'm thinking, you know, this was my first race. I'm never doing this again. I'm never running another marathon. I'm not going to stop running. This is it for me. I'm going to go for it. I mean, it's also like 90 degrees, so you're not moving that fast, right? But it's still a lot. But it was chaos at that point, and they had head. It was surreal because they had helicopters buzzing the race and, you know, blaring out, stop running. The race is over. So we finished the race, and it was also really confusing on the course because they were taking aid stations down, but there were still runners on the course, and it was just kind of one of those crazy things. And I crossed the finish line, and I got my medal, and, you know, it counted as a race, and I thought, wow, I totally have to go do this again.
So just having that experience was not about to deter you, that sounds like.
I didn't know enough that I should have been deterred, actually. I think if I had been more experienced and and just had, you know, a better sense of how it was supposed to go, I might have dropped out or done something different, but I just didn't really know enough, and I felt pretty good throughout the whole race. It was a slow time. I think I did a 5:15. It was my slowest race ever, but, you know, when it's that hot out, you just can't expect to be fast.
Can you talk about some of the ways that you prepare mentally and physically for something like this?
Absolutely. I think running is 90% mental. And it's all about believing that you can do it and getting out there and, you know, having the courage to drag yourself out of the house every day and having the courage to drag yourself mentally through a race. When I did my qualifier in Detroit, it was hard. It was the fastest I'd ever run. And the last part of the race was just flat-on mental toughness. I mean, I know that's kind of a cliche. And I think that's true for any marathon. There's a saying that you run the first part of a marathon on your legs, and you run the second part on your training, and you run the third part on your heart, or something like that. And that's really true. For that race, I had a lot of confidence because I had trained really hard for it. And something kind of hit me a week or two before the race that I knew I could qualify because I knew I had done the training, and I believed in it, and I believed in myself. It wasn't just hope at that point. I run other races where I know that I can't break any records or I can't do anything, and that's fine, and you just go out and run for the enjoyment of it. But the hardest part about running, I think, is getting out and doing it mentally. Once you start, physically running isn't that hard. It feels great. You get through the first mile, and your body fires up, and you know everything kind of, the kinks get worked out, and it totally uplifts your mood. I go to these races, and I see people of every age, shape, size, every walk of life out running, and that's why I mean that running is so inclusive and democratic, because it's for everyone. It's not a big, I mean, racing can be kind of a financial commitment because marathon fees are expensive, but just getting out and running is not expensive. But for me, having the discipline to finish marathons and knowing that I could do that has helped me kind of finish some other things in my life and put some other things together. I had this dissertation that I'd been writing for years, and I wasn't sure I was ever going to finish. And I remember when I was finishing it, I was like, wow, I can do this, partly because I finished a marathon. And if I can run a marathon, then I can do anything.
Elizabeth Demers, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, Melissa, thanks so much for having me on. I was just thrilled to do it.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Earlier this hour, Current State spoke with the latest candidate to announce in Michigan's 8th Congressional District. That's Ingham County Clerk Eric Schertzing, or Ingham County Treasurer Eric Schertzing, I beg your pardon. We just learned of another new candidate, Preston Brooks, a self-described independent, has announced his candidacy today. Mr. Brooks is a retired Navy captain, an entrepreneur, and a professor on the Computer Science and Engineering Permanent Faculty at Oakland University. Mr. Brooks ran as an independent for the 8th Congressional District in 2012. He gathered over 3,000 petition signatures and received more than 6,000 votes. Again, independent Preston Brooks, a candidate for Michigan's 8th District Congressional seat. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll discuss white nose syndrome, a disease that could devastate the bat population in Michigan. Also, we'll learn more about addressing mental health in the Muslim community. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Labrie. Also, thanks Aaron Young for engineering and to Kelsey Block for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.